Let's call 20-9630 Munto Toledo versus Garland. And for the petitioner, Mr. Snavely, you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. The BIA violated its own regulations by referring this case to a three-member panel. None of the mandatory circumstances described in the regs are present. The 10th Circuit held in Uinororo that three-member panel review is only for particularly difficult or important cases. And yet the BIA in this case clearly did not believe that there were inconsistencies among IJs that needed to be resolved, or a need to make precedent, or a need to clean up some kind of error made by the IJ. And while this case is certainly important to my client, it is not particularly difficult, nor does it involve matters of national importance.
Thus, counsel, how is your client prejudiced by this?
Because in an appeal to the BIA reviewed by one member, she only has to persuade that one member that the IJ was wrong. When there's a three-member panel, she has to persuade two members that the IJ is wrong. Therefore, her burden doubles. If it was referred to a one-person panel, maybe she would have gotten someone other than the three panel members that this was referred to. And so I believe that the improper referral of this planet of this case to a three-member panel does prejudice my client.
I would analyze it the opposite way, but maybe that's me.
Was the decision to assign this to a three-member panel, is that even reviewable in this court?
I believe it is under the Batalova case. I believe under Batalova, this court can review whether the BIA followed its own regulations in determining whether to refer this case to a one-member panel or to a three-member panel.
Didn't you argue that the IJ's decision was not in conformity with the law or with applicable precedent?
But the BIA did not make that finding. The BIA clearly.
No, I'm not talking about the BIA. I'm talking about your claims or your arguments before either the IJ or the BIA.
There was an argument made.
You argued a misapplication of precedent?
There was an argument made to the BIA that the case of MEVG should not be applied. And there was an argument made to the BIA that an additional particular social group should be analyzed.
So under E6, Romanet 3, a three-judge panel of the BIA is appropriate. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Because they decided that it was in conformity with the law or applicable precedents.
Well, that's the purpose of an appeal, to make a decision. I just don't follow your argument at all.
But it goes to this. It starts with the one. This is reviewed by a one-member screening panel under their member.
Mr. Snavely, we've lost you. We've lost your connection. If you can hear me, Mr. Snavely, you're frozen and unheard. Okay, we're going to turn back to our first case. Let me make sure that Mr. Snavely and Mr. Shukard are with us. And I understand Mr. Snavely is going to appear by telephone. Is that correct?
He is, Judge. Mr. Snavely, if you're having trouble unmuting your phone, if you hit *6, that should unmute your phone.
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
Yes, we can. And then, Mr. Shukard, could you just unmute and I can be confident that you're with us, too?
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, I think we had, if you could set the clock at 12 minutes. All right, thank you, Paul. Mr. Snavely, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court. Your Honor, The agency decision, which would actually properly be before this court for review, is the ruling that the particular social groups proffered by Kenya to the IJ are not cognizant. And in Uen Roro, the Tenth Circuit held that a three-member panel decision requires the issuance of a full explanatory decision, and that this full explanatory opinion completely supersedes the IJ opinion for purposes of Tenth Circuit review. Here, the BIA decision actually addresses three issues, but the only one that matters is the ruling that the PSGs proffered by Kenya to the IJ were not cognizant. And that's at the second sentence of the third paragraph in the BIA decision at page 3 of the record. But confusing the matter is the first sentence of that same paragraph, where the three-member panel says that they adopt and affirm the IJ decision and cite to Bourbano. I believe that this should be read as the BIA adopting and affirming the IJ's decision because the IJ properly determined that none of Kenya's proffered PSGs were cognizable. And I believe that because if the first sentence is read as an attempt by the panel to incorporate by reference all of the reasons set forth by the IJ in his decision for denying relief, the second sentence is rendered superfluous. Also, reading that adopt and affirm language as incorporation of the IJ's entire decision would bring us back around to how is this a three-member panel properly dealing with a particularly important or difficult case if it's just going to incorporate by reference the IJ's entire decision. Also, it would constitute a circumvention of the Tenth Circuit's holdings in Uen Roro and Sitabatar that a three-member panel decision completely supersedes the IJ's decision and the court should not review the IJ decision. Short of proceedings en banc, I don't believe that can be done. In addition, reading the line as a complete incorporation of the IJ decision suggests a reading of this that is actually a fourth kind of BIA decision, what I guess we would call full panel review and brief order. And again, in light of Uen Roro and Sitabatar, I don't believe this can be done without an en banc proceeding. Into the merits of the BIA decision itself, the BIA committed error because one of the particular social groups proffered by Kenya to the IJ is cognizant, and that particular social group is Salvadoran women working for NGOs, and it's cognizant for an analysis of past persecutions.
Could I just ask you about that last point? Was that particular social group presented to the BIA?
It was not presented in the brief, but it was reviewed by the BIA. The BIA determined that none of Kenya's proffered particular social groups were cognizant, and therefore it was exhausted.
So I take it then that your position is that by making that general statement, even though the issue wasn't presented, it's still exhausted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I take it the argument is that the BIA passed upon the issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Well, to follow up on that, if it wasn't presented to the BIA on appeal, presumably they were not given any reasons why the immigration judge committed error. And wouldn't you have to demonstrate why women working for NGOs was erroneously disregarded below, and there was no arguments made to the BIA on that? What basis reversing that determination of the immigration judge, assuming that we can peek at it? I just don't see that you gave a reason for any error by the immigration judge that the BIA could reverse on.
Well, they say in the decision that they properly determined that none of the respondents proffered particular social groups as legally cognizable. That implies that they reviewed the particular social groups offered by Kenya.
You didn't offer a reason for them to disagree with the BIA on that point. The only social group that you argued on appeal was the Salvadoran women making substantial funds, something to that effect. How can you win before us on an issue that was not presented and argued to the BIA?
But if they choose to review the issue, they can do that whether it's argued by either party or not. And I believe that it, we can take that as an, we can imply from their statement that they reviewed and made a finding that of non-cognizance to all of the proffered groups offered by Kenya, including Salvadoran women working for NGOs.
Well, you know, when that happens in this court, if we don't have an argument on something, we affirm because we haven't given a reason that there's been an error below. Why wouldn't the same principle, is there something about the immigration appeal system that precludes or obviates the need to give a reason for reversal?
Well, the only reason given by the immigration judge for finding this particular social group as non-cognizable is that he found that it wasn't immutable. And so I think it's fair.
And what, I think what's the rebuttal to the social group be and still be a group?
I'm sorry, Arm. I didn't hear that.
How small can a social group be and still be a group? Sounds to me like this is a de minimis number of people.
Well, actually, not in El Salvador. In El Salvador, there are a lot of non-governmental organizations.
Does the record tell us that?
At 258, it says that NGOs are required to register with the Salvadoran government. In the U.S. State Department report that's in the record, they list at least 10 NGOs operating in El Salvador that were significant enough to warrant inclusion in the report. And that's at pages 240, 241, 254, through 256, 260, 261, and 266.
Does the record tell us how many numerically people there are in this social group that you're defining for us?
No, I don't believe it does.
Thank you.
How do you, what's your response to the BIA's conclusion or you know, the government's position that people in this group can leave the job, therefore it's not immutable?
Because we're talking about something that has happened in the past. She was a member. She was part of this NGO from 2014 through 2015. That is not immutable.
That's not the argument you made. That's not the particular social group that you argued. Your claim was it was Salvadoran women working for NGOs. That's not past tense.
Right. But I don't think I don't think we have to have a PSG framed in the past tense in order for it to be evaluated for a claim of past persecution.
Well, if members of a group can leave the group, then you haven't met your burden of showing that it's immutable.
Well, I think that even the government cited to a couple of cases in their brief where they're talking about how past employment can be immutable. Talking about
if you could just tell me if you prevail in this case, give me precisely what the social group is that this court should recognize?
It has to be Salvadoran women working for NGOs.
All right, thank you.
The group the members of the group share the mutable characteristics of being Salvadoran, being female, and past employment by an NGO. Court should grant petition for judicial review and remand back to the BIA, asking them to complete the adjudication of the petitioner's applications for asylum and withholding of removal. If there aren't any more questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Right, you'll have 55 seconds.
Okay.
All right, let's hear from the government, Mr. Shukard.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good afternoon. It's afternoon for me. May it please the court. This is a pretty straightforward case. And if I may be a little bit presumptuous, I feel as though I sensed a little bit of Your Honor's confusion when questioning my opponent. And I'd like you to hold on to that feeling because, respectfully, a lot of her arguments simply don't make a lot of sense. She is asking you to limit your scope of review in a completely arbitrary way. And she's asserting a regulatory violation in which the remedy is that the board would remand the case, or you would remand the case to the board so that the board could take it less seriously. These things, I mean, the board did a good job in this case. The remedy here is nothing. And so your task here today is simply to affirm that the law works in common sense ways that we would all expect. I'll begin with the scope of review issue, which is actually a waiver issue. The immigration judge in this case made about around 20 adverse findings and holdings in denying the petitioner's claims for relief and protection from removal. Some of them were independently dispositive. The board on appeal clearly and explicitly adopted and affirmed all of the IJ's holdings. And then it devoted the rest of its order to responding to the petitioner's particular argument. She made an argument about a PSG and about the state of the law in analyzing PSG's particular social groups I'm talking about. In Sudabitar v. Gonzalez, this court said, when the board does that, it exhausts all of these issues for review sua sponte and ripens them for judicial review. But of those around 20 findings and holdings, the petitioner appealed just one to this court. That's it. That's the end of her case. She left almost all of the dispositive issues on the table. The one issue she did raise, it doesn't matter what we say here today about it, although it lacks merit. And that should be the end of the petition for review. Her argument regarding the case, the U in Aurora, in asking you to interpret U in Aurora that broadly, she is asking you to do something that you've never done before, that, as far as I can find, no court of appeals has ever done, which is to base your scope of review entirely on the number of board members who have signed an order. That doesn't make any sense. The board doesn't distinguish its orders between single board member or three member panel in terms of their ability to adopt and affirm. It is, in fact, explicitly authorized, if you look in the regulations at 1003.1E9, it says that board members, be they singular or three-member panels, can adjudicate issues that neither party raised. That's an adopt and affirm. So the board makes no distinction here. And to be sure, if this had been a single board member order with the exact same words in it in this case, we wouldn't be having this discussion. But the only difference here is how many board members handled the case. There's no reason you should willfully blind yourself to what's in the record when the board has explicitly said, here are all the findings and conclusions that we're relying upon. It's giving you a big flashing arrow saying, here they are in the record. There's no reason to do that.
It really doesn't matter then that that she failed to appeal the Salvadoran women working for NGOs, in your view?
No, I think that the board exhausted that sua sponte when it adopted the IJ's entire decision. And that's a pretty standard, I believe a solid majority of circuit courts view it the same way. And it's, this court has said as much in Sudabitar and then its progeny. And in encountering the situation, this court has actually recognized that UN Aurora doesn't cover the situation. It's narrower than that. In the case of Zoranovic v. Sessions, that's 713 Federal Appendix 794. This is from 2018. The exact same scenario was presented. It was a three board member panel. The petitioner argued that the IJ's words were erased because it was a three member panel. And the court said, no, UN Aurora doesn't cover that, that it was a novel issue. You elected not to decide the issue that day, but you can decide it today. It's directly in front of you and it's dispositive. UN Aurora says that when a three member panel issues a quote unquote full explanatory opinion, it supersedes the IJ, but again, that's not what the court did. It pointed you in the record to where its findings and conclusions were. And there's really only one.
Just to be clear then, what you're telling us is that particular social group issue concerning Salvadoran women working for NGOs has been exhausted.
Yeah, the board exhausted that itself, sua sponte, right, under Sudabitar.
Okay. And could you address the immutability argument that's being made here?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. So particular social groups, among other things, have to be immutable. Immutability is changelessness. It's static. An immutable characteristic is something that is fundamental to a person's identity, gender, race, kinship, things like that. In this case, we're talking
about... Do the members of the social group have to know each other? Do they have to engage socially? Is there anything that ties them together? Or in a typical social group, you could just say, oh, well, everybody who's a janitor in Guatemala is in that social group.
No, they don't have to have like a club or anything like that. There is a separate requirement for particular social groups called social distinction. And in that sense, they have to be known as a group by the society in question. If you found out that someone, for example, if the petitioner's proposed group were cognizable and were socially distinct, it would be if someone said, oh, that person works for an NGO. Those people have a certain set of characteristics. I know about that. It's people who are recognized as distinct. Agency in this case didn't rule on the group social distinction. They confined themselves to immutability. And again, we're talking about a job here. Petitioner quit her job. That's at 160 to 61 in the record. She quit the job. The NGO doesn't operate in El Salvador anymore. She's not getting that job back. And critically, petitioner's counsel, current counsel, conceded to IJ that she wasn't a member of the group anymore precisely because she had quit. That's not an immutable group. If you can leave and enter your group at will, that's not a fundamental characteristic. It's a job. Petitioner is confusing an issue a little bit by talking about this as a thing that happened in the past. Whether your membership is present or past, the group itself still has to be immutable. She did not have to work for the NGO in the past when these things happened to her. She could have quit the job then. She didn't. Things happened to her. Doesn't make the group immutable. It makes the experience part of her identity. She was kidnapped once upon a time. That's terrible. That's not going to change. But the fact that she was working for an NGO in 2014 or whenever this incident took place doesn't matter because it's not based on a fundamental characteristic for her.
It always be a part of her identity that she was a Salvadoran woman working for an NGO or who had worked for an NGO. And if there's an allegation that those people have been targeted because of their past associations, she can't change the fact that she worked there. So, you know, if she's targeted because she worked for an organization and there's nothing she can do to change that historical fact, why wouldn't that work for the appellant petitioner?
because the group that he formulated, she formulated, excuse me, is based on present employment. If you look in her brief, she explicitly excludes people who aren't currently working for NGOs from the group. That's on page 18. That's part of her particularity argument, because particularity is a sort of line drawing exercise that tells you a group is narrow enough to not be too squishy to be recognized. But in making that argument,
let me ask you what I call a Robert Henry question, our former colleague. Under what scenario would you lose?
In what scenario would we lose?
Yeah. Under what scenario do you lose on this point?
You know, at the risk of sounding arrogant, Your Honor, I cannot conceive of a way that we would lose on this issue, because she's admitted she's not part of the group. The group is not immutable.
Well, she was part of the group when she was held up, right?
She was. But the group even then was not cognizable. Just because you say you're in a group doesn't mean you're in a particular social group under the Immigration and Nationality Act. You have to show that this group is based in part on a characteristic that you cannot change about yourself. So in 2014, when she was working for an NGO and some people kidnapped her, that wasn't part of her identity. She could have quit the job that morning. She could have quit the job that day.
She belongs to the Communist Party and quits. The party is still, I suppose, a cognizable group, right?
Political opinions are analyzed separately.
So your position here isn't that she wasn't in the group. It's just that the group wasn't immutable.
My position, to clarify this, is that once upon a time she was a member of this group, and then she left. And the fact that she could just leave proves that it's not cognizable. You cannot leave.
Back to my previous question, all the janitors in a country, that can't be a social group, because they can all quit.
Exactly. If the group is formulated as this one is, based on present employment, that's not a particular social group.
What kind of social groups do exist that are immutable? Give us some examples.
There are groups based on kinship ties. For example, tribal affiliations, family affiliations, immediate family. There are groups based on gender, sexual orientation.
But they're a gender. I mean, people can change their gender and sexual orientation. They can change their sexual orientation. Just every example you give me sounds to me that people could quit.
That's debatable. And probably the case law hasn't caught up to the current recognition of how gender and sexual orientation work. But it is illustrative of how fundamental these things are supposed to be. And past experiences are fundamental, because no one can change their past. So if petitioner had formulated a group saying, I will be persecuted in El Salvador because I used to work for an NGO, then we'd be talking about something.
That comes back to my question. The way you would lose this case is if on page 18 of petitioner's brief, instead of using a gerund, he said Salvadoran women who used to work for NGOs is a particularized social group, right? Isn't that a winning argument for him?
It would perhaps help him to establish the cognizability of the group, but he would still have to show particularity, social distinction. Neither of those holdings are in the record. Plus, he would have to show nexus. He would have to show that she would have to show that she was harmed on account of being in this group, and she has waived the nexus holding. The IJ found that she was not harmed on account of her membership in the group, regardless, because she was targeted by a gang who were enlarging their own personal criminal enterprise.
You know, what we talked about here when I was thinking about this case, you know, what if hypothetically this were Afghani women who worked for an Afghanistan NGO or for the American, you know, presence in that country? Would they have a good asylum claim about being targeted by the Taliban for their previous work for an NGO? And it seems to me that sounds like a pretty good argument.
I would suggest to you that formulating it in such a way as to say it's based on a past experience would probably work, depending on what the evidence in that case was. Saying, I work for the Americans, when you no longer do, that's not immutable. A pretty good social group based on something that you just do voluntarily is never, ever going to be cognizable because you can choose that. This, if I can point out, there was a case that came out after briefing closed in this case in the circuit. The case is Oriana Racinos. It's published 993 F3rd 851, if I'm reading my writing correctly. Now, in that case, the particular social group that the petitioner raised was family-based ostensibly. But what was happening was the gang was pressuring the petitioner to pressure her son to join the gang. The son was resisting gang recruitment. And I will quote you. You said that if he did join, she would not be at risk. That is an immutability finding. If you can choose to leave the group and avoid the persecution, you don't have a social group. You don't have it. You need it. She doesn't have it in this case. Even if she did, she failed on the nexus ground because she waived it. She also failed on the government role ground. She waived it. This entire case is waived. As I said in the beginning, no matter what we say about this group, the case is entirely gone. I only have a few seconds left. I would like to touch on the regulatory issue, if your honors are interested, or if you have any questions about that.
Quickly, you got it. I'll give you 20 seconds on that.
Okay. The petitioner, again, is asking for the remedy that she needs is a reversal, that only a three board member panel can give her that. She's saying that a single board member should have decided her case, but a single board member can't resolve her issue. All he could do is deny on the grounds that she offered. Remember, she raised an unexhausted issue to the court and argued that he hadn't followed the IJ hadn't followed Third Circuit law, even though we're in the Tenth Circuit. There's nothing for the board to do on remand but deny this case by a single board member. There's no remedy here, even if there is some kind of violation.
All right, counsel, I think we understand your argument. Let's go ahead and give Mr. Snavely 60 seconds. I'll give him a few more. And then,
Mr. Jennifer,
go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, a single board member may reverse the decision under review if such reversal is plainly consistent with and required by intervening board or judicial precedent. So a single board member could grant relief. Secondly, the persecution occurred before she left the group. Thirdly, this group is cognizable in regards to particularity. The following are excluded from the group: people who are not female, those who are not Salvadoran, people who are not employed, employed people who don't work for an NGO, employed people who work for an NGO which is not registered with the Salvadoran government. It is also socially distinct. I talk about this on pages 19 and 20 in my reply brief. In El Salvador, NGOs are required to register with the government. Those in El Salvador, NGOs are a group, and if the NGOs are socially distinct, then so are the employees of the NGO. It does make a difference in this circuit, according to Sotomayor, whether the decision from the BIA is either a single member or a three member.
You have to show persecution of others in the same social group. Is that part of your burden? Or is it just enough to say one person in the social group was targeted?
I think that it's sufficient to say that one person.
How would you
in the
think?
Group is,
I'm just asking. Under the case law, do you have to show that others are targeted, or is it enough to just show one, your client?
I believe it's enough to show one. My understanding is that the person has to be targeted on account of their membership in a particular social group. It doesn't matter whether the other members of a particular social group are also targeted or not targeted. Whether they are would go to whether would probably help the alien meet the burden of proof.
I didn't mean by my question to extend this to unlimited argument. So I think you've answered my question.
Great. Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired. The counsel are excused, and the case shall be submitted.